Previously on Beta.
Oh, I can't change my habits. I'll be sleeping all day, awake all night.
It's Milwaukee.
It's only an hour's difference, Otis. You won't even notice.
Yeah, I'll be hungry at 5. I'll be ready for the local news at 4.
Waterboy! Check this out.
Because the words will not reach your brain without closed captioning.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, comedian Gary Gulman on his battles with depression and anxiety.
I would have been better served by a community that had the same values as millennials, that were as aware of mental illness, as aware of the damage that bullying and teasing and being selfish causes.
Also, producer and musician Joe Henry talks about his album, The Gospel According to Water.
I got a diagnosis of cancer, and all of these songs kind of grew out of that experience, but none of these songs are about cancer. I would never write a cancer song. That doesn't interest me.
That's all coming up later this hour.
Welcome to the White Man's Guide to White Male Writers of the Western Canon. If you're not a white male novelist who has established himself as an essential part of the Western canon, fear not. This guide is here to help. I will teach you everything you need to know to become the chain-smoking, coffee-drinking, Proust-quoting, award-winning writer you've always known you should be.
That's Dana Schwartz reading an excerpt from her book, The White Man's Guide to White Male Writers of the Western Canon. The premise of the book is that it's written by Dana's alter ego from her very popular Twitter account, Guy in Your MFA. Who better than the cocky guy in your MFA writing class to mansplain the most important white male writers to us?
The truth is, I really didn't think that I was going to write a Guy in Your MFA book. I thought that, you know, I started that parody Twitter account when I was a senior in college, and it was just sort of this cathartic way to get out my frustrations with sort of the condescension of the lit majors at my undergrad university, and to just put jokes out into the world on Twitter, which was not something I, you know, had any experience with. Mm-hmm. And I had thought at the time about turning it into a book, but it turned out to be really hard to take sort of that, not to say it's one joke, but definitely one note character and expand his voice over an entire book. It got just genuinely like tiresome. And so I just sort of let it sit and worked on other projects. I wrote a young adult novel and a memoir, which you were kind enough to talk to me about. And, you know, I wrote a Deadpool comic, which was super fun and, you know, worked as an entertainment journalist. And then sort of over the years, I had this sort of nagging suspicion that I could take that voice, that character Guy in Your MFA, and use his voice to make jokes about other literary figures. And once I had that idea about sort of using him as your tour guide to white male writers, I just couldn't let go of it. I was like, how fun to have like a Cliff's Notes version of all the high art literary writers and then have this horrible, infuriating tour guide. And I also had became friends with this incredible illustrator, Jason Katzenstein, who did cartoons throughout the book. And I think once we joined up and had this idea, it just became too fun not to do.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's so much fun to read. Can you tell us a bit about the backstory of Guy in Your MFA? Does he have a name, about his education, his worldview?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he doesn't have a name particularly.
Okay.
I think because he's sort of the everyman. He's both the guy in your writing workshop, maybe the professor, probably the barista at your local Starbucks, almost certainly the intern at the literary magazine you submitted your story to. But if you had to have a name, it would probably be Jonathan, for semi-obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Just feels right.
Or maybe Jeffrey. What about Jeffrey? Wouldn't be Jeff. Maybe Jeffrey. Jeffrey, maybe.
He could be a Jeff.
Yeah.
He could be a Jeff. I accept.
Okay.
you went to a Ivy League undergraduate liberal arts school.
Mm-hmm.
May or may not have been the one I attended, but maybe not. And he attended a prestigious MFA for creative writing. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Iowa or Cornell or Brown, or fill in the blanks for whichever one intimidates you the most.
Yeah, yeah. Is this character based on a person or persons, you know, or is he based on pop culture representations? Is he a Noah Baumbach character, perhaps?
You know, actually, it's so funny. Just two nights ago, I watched The Squid and the Whale for the first time. And
oh,
I was
really?
Like, my jaw was dropped the entire time. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. It's like the father character in that movie is the grown up. It's Guy in Your MFA plus 30 years.
Reading A Tale of Two Cities in English. Is that any good?
It's minor Dickens. Popular in schools, but I think David Copperfield or Great Expectations is much richer. What is it about high school that you read all the worst books by good writers?
I would say two things. I think he's based particularly on the dudes in my undergraduate writing workshop. Uh-huh. I wasn't an English lit major, and so I definitely felt always like I was an interloper when I, you know, was in writing seminars.
Yeah.
And so I think I sort of took all of my feelings of insecurity and gave them a face, and Guy is that face. But he's also, I mean, I think every writer has a little bit of Guy in Your MFA on the inside. Like, he's also, you know, a bit of me. He's all of my pretentious, terrible ideas when I'm like, ooh, what if I did a modern day retelling of Hamlet, but gritty? And then I have to take a step back and be like, nope, that's not a good idea, Dana. You know, he's a lot of bluster, but it comes from a place of a vulnerability.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Let's talk about a few of the white male writers that you include in your book, starting with David Foster Wallace. Where does DFW, if I may be so bold as to use his initials, where does DFW fit into the Western canon?
You know, I think DFW is, I'm also going to be so bold. I mean, I think he's an incredible writer, and I think the legacy of his, you know, early death definitely sort of exalted him to this high status of sort of underground hero. I was less interested in writing like a, you know, legitimate analysis or criticism of his work. And I was more interested in gently poking fun at the people who see his name as synonymous with high art. You know, the people who use his name to prove that they're well-read or sophisticated. Because the truth is, if you've ever opened Infinite Jest, that is a tome of a book. That is a dense book with a lot of footnotes and endnotes, and it is a undertaking.
Yes.
And so I think that the people who read it like to wear it as a badge of honor. And so that's sort of what I like to poke fun at, this idea that just by reading a certain book, you're better than other people, which that's just not a good way to live life.
Yeah, no, it's not. You're absolutely right. What are the Wallace works that I, as a white man, need to know?
Oh, I think the most important, actually the one that I read when I was an undergraduate, was Consider the Lobster, which is his book of essays, which is genuinely a great book of essays, and I like it. I think one of the funny things about writing this book is people assume that because I'm making fun of white male writers that I don't like them, which isn't true at all. I would hope anyone who reads the book realizes very quickly it comes from a place of love. And there's a ton of white male writers that I really love. You know, some of my closest friends are white male writers. I also quote in the book, I give, you know, jokey blurbs to This Is Water, which is his famous commencement address.
Yeah, Kenyon and then, of course, College, right?
Yeah. And then, of course, The Pale King, which is his posthumous unfinished novel, which can go on to be an example for all of us to just leave unfinished notes littered throughout our desk when we die so someone else can put them together.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the master of minimalism, Raymond Carver, and how his work stacks up against the other male writers of the Western canon?
Oh, I think the fun thing about Raymond Carver, and I think that the thing that the guy in your MFA thing likes to point out about is his collaboration with Gordon Lish. Obviously, he was so heavily edited by the famous Gordon Lish, and I think any guy in your MFA worth his salt would point out or want to sneer at a cocktail party that Carver's works are actually secondary. And he was only, you know, celebrated because of that collaboration.
What are the essential Raymond Carver works?
Oh, well, definitely What We Talk About When We Talk About Love.
Mm-hmm.
both because, you know, that's an amazing short story. And also that's now the title that I think everyone parodies for what we talk about when we talk about insert whatever you want
yes,
to talk about
yes,
here.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's like that what we talk about when we talk about blank is its own industrial
exactly.
complex.
So
now. Yeah.
If you want to be, you know, well-read in the literary canon, that's the Carver biggie.
Mm-hmm. You also include Cormac McCarthy in your book, and you have this very helpful hint for those of us who want to write McCarthy-esque fiction. It has to do with punctuation. Can you share this tip with us?
Yes. Well, the thing about Cormac McCarthy is just do not do punctuation. If you were under the impression that punctuation was put in books to make it easier to read and comprehend, you are sadly mistaken, my friend, because that's just the shorthand. No matter how talented you are, if you just want to, you know, up your game, the Cormac McCarthy secret is just removing punctuation just to make it that much harder for everyone to read.
Yeah. And you have that great line about semicolons.
Oh, God, yes. When you want to write like Cormac McCarthy, you must remember that semicolons are for women and the French. Do not abide by their neither here nor there nonsense. Either end a sentence or don't, but by God, make a decision.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah, he's a very, anyone who's read Cormac McCarthy knows he's a very percussive writer.
Yes, yes, yes. You recently did an AMA and Ask Me Anything on Reddit, and you said on Twitter that there was one question from your Reddit AMA. Do you think there's irony in the fact that you're a privileged white person with a white writer boyfriend who published a book with illustrations from a white male cartoonist about the issues of Caucasian dominance in the literary world?
The thing is, yes, I am a white person making fun of white male writers. But if I can't make fun of white male writers, then who can I make fun of? Truly, like, if I can't make fun of Shakespeare and Faulkner and the, you know, pretentious bro from Brooklyn who loves them, then what is left for me to mock and make gentle jokes about? Like, anyone who reads this book knows that it is a pretty gentle satire that both celebrates these writers at the same time I'm making fun slightly of like the pretentious person who dismisses everyone else. But yeah, it's worth pointing out that the people who defined the Western canon or the high literary canon, you know, decades ago were all white men mm-hmm. who chose and exalted books that, you know, celebrate their own perspective and point of view. And whether they did that consciously or unconsciously, the books they chose are ones that resonated with them, probably because, you know, they related to their experiences. And I think it shouldn't be considered a crazy political or subversive act to say, hey, maybe now that it's 2019, we can point that out and make jokes about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's very well said, yeah. Do you think that your book will help us become more aware of how much white male writers dominate our culture and also bring more attention to white women writers and women writers of color?
I hope so. I mean, the thing is, one book can't do everything. I'm not trying to, you know, I had fun writing this character and I wanted to make a, you know, book filled with jokes so people can sort of feel well-read if they felt insecure their whole life about certain writers. I don't know. I don't purport for this to be the book that's going to change the conversation because it is, as you say, so male dominated and it continues to be. I mean, you look at submissions for major literary awards and it's disheartening how male skewing the literary community remains. But I do hope that this book at least, you know, helps people laugh at it a little bit, you know, helps people enjoy or get at least a cathartic response to that frustration. Mm-hmm. That would just be the goal, that someone can just, you know, read it and enjoy it, feel a little more empowered and not silenced by that, you know, pretentious gatekeeping of the literary world.
Yeah. Let's try a bit of a literary thought experiment. If you had the power, you, Dana Schwartz, had the power, say this book is a huge hit kind of thing and has a lot of impact and a lot of cultural influence, and you were somehow put in charge, I don't know, by the American Library Association or something to create a new canon, a Western canon of literature, what would your new canon look like?
Oh, my God, that's a great question. I mean, the truth is I would have definitely some of these same writers in it. I would have, you know, William Shakespeare, obviously, Kurt Vonnegut, Kafka, Fitzgerald, Tolstoy. But then I would also want to include, like, you know, some women who have been maybe overlooked or forgotten. Obviously, Jane Austen, the Brontes, who aren't overlooked, but then authors like Muriel Sparks, Patricia Highsmith, Zadie Smith. I think everyone should read White Teeth. It's one of my absolute favorite books. That's such a good question. I think that, and then there are some really great books that came out recently that I would add to the canon. I would add Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff, which came out within the decade. I'm shooting my shot. I'm calling my shot and saying that that should be a canonical book.
Yeah, and Lauren Groff did her MFA, I think, creative writing here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, if I'm not mistaken.
She's an incredible
Yeah,
writer.
She's really good in her short
stories. I love everything she does.
Yeah, her new
collection. Oh, Florida.
Florida's great, too. Yeah, yeah. What are the most valuable literary lessons and life lessons that we can learn from Jonathan, your alter ego, and from you?
You know, I think the lesson that you need to take from him as a character is confidence in your own work and your own commitment to your genius.
Yeah.
I think, you know, to some degree it can be hurtful, but I think so many people are incredibly insecure and afraid to put their own writing out in the world. And I think we could all use a little, you know, guy in your MFA to whisper that, like, no, you're actually a genius and put your work out there.
Yeah, but you don't think, to cut you off, Dana, but you don't think Jonathan goes too far and, like, is overconfident and suffering from hubris? Hubris?
He definitely does, but I think all the rest of us could use just a sprinkle of it.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. A sprinkle
of it. And then the lesson for me is a lesson that I'm still learning, is there's no one checking your list at the end of your life to see what books you've read and what you haven't read. There's no master list. No one cares what you're reading. No one's paying attention or checking off to make sure you actually read Moby Dick. Life is so short, and there's a finite number of books you can read in your life, and you should read things you enjoy. There's no use of give everything a try, sure. But you shouldn't have to suffer through reading something because you feel like you have to, because no one is paying attention. As long as you're reading and enjoying and enriching your life, my personal take is that's the most important thing.
Dana Schwartz, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Dana Schwartz is a podcast host and the author of The White Man's Guide to White Male Writers of the Western Canon. Find out more about Dana at WPR.org/beta.
I just know empirically, from being very sick, from being very negative, from being very pessimistic, that I wrote very little, and very little of what I wrote was very good.
Stand-up comedian Gary Gulman on his struggles with depression and anxiety. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I was so sick. I couldn't perform at all. And I was contemplating retiring from comedy. And then I thought about it some and realized that retirement is a bit pretentious for what was going on. Like, Johnny Carson retired. Michael Jordan retired. Gary Gulman, you're giving up.
That's comedian Gary Gulman from his HBO comedy special, The Great Depression. He's been a comic for over 25 years and has battled depression the entire time. His new special is part stand-up, part documentary, and it highlights Gary's journey to find the funny in the very dark and serious subject matter. Gary talked candidly with us about his personal history of mental illness.
I would say at about 7 years old, I started to feel what I know now are the symptoms of depression and anxiety, but I didn't have a name for it back then. I just thought I was constantly in fear and anxious about my schoolwork and my teachers and the classmates and my future, and I would become very sad and isolated and would spend a lot of time ruminating over things I was afraid of and just feeling very poorly about myself. My self-esteem was not very strong.
Did your mother realize that you were depressed when you were 7 years old?
No, my mom was like most American moms in that she didn't have much information on mental health and mental illness. And while my father's mother was bipolar, they really weren't even aware of the heredity involved in mental illness. So like most Americans, my mom was pretty ignorant about the signs and the symptoms, and I felt a little bit bad about sort of exposing her obliviousness in the special, but at the same time I thought she was such a great surrogate for America and people of that generation and even some younger generations just aren't aware, and they don't know what to look for, and they don't know the symptoms or the signs, and that's a problem.
A happier kid you couldn't find. Always had a smile on his face.
Oh, see how happy he was. I mean, come on.
This is a book I wrote in second grade. It was called The Lonely Tree, and it was to anybody with a small amount of psychology knowledge, you would know this was a cry for help, that it was an allegory a lonely, sad. See, the tree was being teased by the animals in the forest, and it cried and it grew and it became beautiful and became the Christmas tree in the city, and it grew from tears.
Happy-go-lucky kid. Well, that's the way he always was.
Seems like to me something that you could possibly revive now. Seriously,
I wonder. Yeah. I hate to be one of those guys who cashes in on all his assets, but I think that maybe I'll just print a print or disseminate a PDF version of it to my followers and fans and friends and whatnot.
I think it could be quite helpful to young children today. Yeah, you played basketball in high school. Did that offer you any relief from your depression?
Well, the interesting thing about basketball was it was a source of relief, but also at times a source of anxiety and pressure. And I had put so much into my basketball accomplishments and achievements that when I had an off game, when I missed shots, I would get so down on myself, and it became an indictment on my character and my person rather than just an off game, and I would just take losses and bad games so seriously.
I fell in love with basketball almost immediately because basketball is the only sport you can practice by yourself. I spent a lot of time practicing basketball by myself, and basketball also fits me because it's the only sport where if somebody so much as slaps you on the wrist, they stop the game. Stop the game, separate everyone, and let you make two easy shots while everyone else is forced to watch quietly. As if to say, think about what you did.
I had a high school coach who was just a cruel man. He wasn't even a good coach. Had he been as effective as some of those mean coaches have been over the years, that would have been one thing. You could say, well, I didn't enjoy him as a person, but I learned a lot and I became a better player. But he was just gratuitously cruel and a real, real mean person. So that was troublesome too. I was very unfortunate to not have a great coach, because a coach can really make the difference for a teenage boy in my position.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. So he was no Bobby Knight, right?
No. He was only the mean, cruel part of Bobby Knight, not the great strategist and motivator.
Mm. You received a football scholarship from Boston College. Can you tell me about your experience playing college football?
Well, I think college football sort of exposed my depression and my mental illness, because it was sort of a crucible for my troubles and my outlook. And I got to Boston College, and I was a very athletic, very big young man, but I didn't have very much confidence, and I certainly didn't have a killer instinct and the instinct to dominate other men my age. And it became clear that the other guys were more aggressive, and I was overwhelmed very early on. And I was overwhelmed as far as my experience and knowledge of football, but also as far as my resolve and my tenacity. So I struggled mightily early on. Like within the first few weeks, I decided that I was either going to quit the football team or I was going to take my own life or do something. And I was just in such a bad place. But luckily, the people involved as a liaison to the athletic department for education, and it was called the Learning Resources for Student Athletes. And the head of that, actually, I went to him and asked him what I should do. And he sent me to a therapist that he was friendly with. And that was the beginning of my treatment of depression, which, like I said, I had experienced since I was 7. But it wasn't until that time at about 18 or 19 that I actually was diagnosed and addressed it, and therapy has been a crucial part of my treatment and my recovery over the years, and has been an invaluable life preserver for me.
Mm, that's great to hear. So tell me a bit about that first session of therapy, the first few sessions. What was it about therapy that you found so helpful?
Well, it was such a release and a relief, because all these things that I hadn't had anybody to talk about, because I was afraid that they would just make me feel worse, or they wouldn't understand, or they would judge me, or I felt embarrassed. So I didn't share these things with my friends. I couldn't talk to my family about them. Even my brothers, I felt, wouldn't understand. Or when I had come forward with things that were bothering me, their response and the reception wasn't helpful. And this was a man who I quickly understood would not judge me or chastise me or make me feel guilty or embarrassed or ashamed. He just listened, and he made observations, and he perceived things that I wasn't even aware of, and he was just these insights that I never would have made on my own, and had received other signals from people that those things really, I should either get over it or that's how life works.
But millennials, they're just much more accepting of each other. They feel safe around each other, accepting. They're accepting of non-conforming gender roles and identities. And I have to be honest with you, in 1987, I didn't feel safe ordering a Sprite. This will sound nuts, but Sprite amongst the men of my community was considered a woman's beverage.
When I watched The Great Depression, I was really struck by your respect for millennials. What is it about this generation that you find so interesting?
Well, there are a few things going on with making blanket statements. And one of the blanket statements that I hear from comedians almost every night is how soft and entitled and impractical millennials are. And I just compare it to my knowledge of the millennials in my life. My wife is a millennial. I have friends who are millennials, other comedians, and I've found that not to be the case for the most part. And I just I also feel that I would have been better served by a community that had the same values as millennials, that were as aware of mental illness, as aware of the damage that bullying and teasing and being undermining and being selfish causes. So I'm really drawn to topics in comedy that I have a strong positive feeling about, because when I was coming up in comedy, and even now, most of the comedians were talking about the things they hated and deriding things and criticizing things. And I think I know I'm tired of it, and if I'm tired of it, then maybe many audiences are tired of it, and I find it's much easier to go through life with an optimistic outlook. I love the philosopher Steven Pinker, who is great at pointing out that things are actually better than they ever have been for most of us, and that there is an upward movement in civility and in quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's great. And that's one of the things that defines your stand-up, is that you're not taking these, you're not always criticizing, very rarely. In fact, you're often being kind and supportive and positive, and that's great.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
You're welcome. There's a scene in your documentary where you're talking to your fellow comedian and longtime friend, Robert Kelly, and you share with him about how you would never talk to anyone about your depression. And one of the things you guys talk about is how comedians worry that curing their depression will hurt their comedy. Is this true?
I think a lot of artists are concerned or believe perhaps that their mental illness or their depressive nature or their negative nature is sort of the inspiration for a lot of their work, and that if they take that out, or if they remove the mental illness or their doom and gloom outlook, then they'll lose their edge, they'll lose their sharpness. And I just know empirically from being on both sides of that, from being very sick, from being very negative, from being very pessimistic, that I wrote very little, and very little of what I wrote was very good.
It's also, too, in my depression, if I remove the depression, then I'm going to remove the funny.
Oh, yeah. Huge myth.
Yeah, it's a myth. Like, if I get married, I'm not going to be funny anymore. If I have a kid,
yeah,
I'm not going to be funny. Yeah. If I get healthy mentally,
any kind of contentment is the enemy of...
Is the enemy of funny, when actually it's the reverse.
Yes, absolutely.
Isn't it weird, though? Why do we think
Are we so old in figuring this out?
to the people who think they'll lose their edge, give it a try. You can always go back to your misery and your discomfort, and if it doesn't work out. But I think that most of us have enough experience with pain and suffering to write about it from a safe spot far away from it.
Hmm. Yeah, very well said. At one point in the Great Depression, we see a watch hanging on a hook by the door, and it doesn't have any numbers on its face. It just has one word, now. Can you tell me a bit about this watch and what it means to you?
Wow, the watch means a great deal to me because, one, it was a present from a friend of mine who runs a day camp for adolescents in Beverly, Massachusetts. And he invited me to be a counselor when I was at my lowest. He felt it would be helpful for me to be engaged during the day and to have some place to go and to be around people and to be doing something nice with kids and sort of be a positive in their life, and so that was very helpful, and also just the actual fact of a watch that says now reminds you that what time it is and where you have to be and what you have going on and all this other stuff is really not something to be anxious over, that you should be present and aware and be in the moment, and time is really this thing that I shouldn't let be a troubling idea in my life.
Mm. Yeah, that's I can relate to that because I've spent so much time. I spend so much time not being in the moment, dreading the past,
right.
Dreading the future, and regretting the past. So yeah, that's great. That's very good advice. You had a role as a comedian in the blockbuster big hit movie Joker, and Joaquin Phoenix's character in the film has such a dark, disturbed, and existential world view. So I'm curious, what do you think of Joker?
I would have seen it even if I wasn't in it.
Yes.
But being in it was very interesting because it actually premiered the day before the Great Depression came out. So it was like the most exciting weekend of my comedy career. And it also dealt with mental illness in a much more stark and bleak manner and actually violent. But it did say a lot about the state of mental health and treatment without being as explicit as I am in the Great Depression. But the thing I found so interesting was that he was a stand-up, and if the stand-up comedy had gone a lot better and he had done well, maybe he wouldn't have turned to a life of crime. And I often, because I know how frustrating and discouraging it can be in stand-up, and some nights you just want to turn to a life of crime rather than have to deal with difficult audiences and uninspired bookers and just the struggle of a young comedian. So I found that very interesting. But my only complaint was that there was an extra who was laughing in the wrong spots, like laughing too hard, clearly trying to get the attention of the director. I don't know how it works, but maybe thinking that they would get a bump up in stature by laughing especially hard. And I was about to complain, and then I realized it was Joaquin Phoenix, and it was the Joker who was laughing, and not somebody who was out of order. It was the Joker. So I laughed to myself at how foolish I was to think that somebody would be cackling that bizarrely. And just an extra. I don't know. Yeah. I think I didn't believe that Joaquin Phoenix would be sitting in on all the takes. I guess that's what I was thinking, that when the camera was pointed on me, that he would have somebody else sitting there, or I don't know.
Yeah, and that's very interesting, because Joaquin Phoenix's character, Arthur Fleck, has this condition where he laughs at inappropriate times.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was yes. perfect. Yeah.
Yes, but it was interesting to watch him, because he was taking notes during the show.
Oh, yeah.
And then when he went on stage, he had his hair just like mine. It was that was part of it, that our hair had to match.
I get out of bed, and some days are a little bit more difficult than others. Never as bad as it was, but some days it's hard to get out of bed, and people say, why is it hard to get out of bed? And I think I know why. This is my theory. The thing they don't tell you about life when you're growing up is this. Life, It's every single day. Thank you.
Gary Goldman is a stand-up comedian. His HBO special, The Great Depression, is available now. Find out more about Gary's story at WPR.org/beta.
As much as I come out of a folk tradition, I come out of a poetic tradition. Our culture contemporarily is not taught to engage with poetry, you know. We're told that poetry is difficult. We're taught that it's not for everybody.
Musician and producer Joe Henry talks about his album, The Gospel According to Water. That's coming up in just a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Joe Henry is a singer-songwriter, guitarist, and producer. He's produced 3 Grammy-winning albums, including Solomon Burke's Don't Give Up on Me. Joe's solo album, The Gospel According to Water, is the first album that he's released since being diagnosed with cancer. He talked about his creative process for the record and what inspired him to record it.
I'm a songwriter, you know.
My eyes are closed, but they are raised. Keeping light both out and in.
And when I write songs, when I have a group of songs that begin to speak to each other, that I start to identify as wanting to be a body of work, I get really obsessed about documenting that, you know, because at this point in my life, you know, writing a song, you know, I don't really think of the border between writing a song and recording one, you know? It just, it's a natural extension to want to articulate it onto a recording in a particular way so that it lives without me. It's the moment of a completion. Just that there's an idea that's intact and now I'm free to go do something else. Either something else with the same songs or something else altogether. So it's just, you know, it's a natural impulse for me to want to record because that's where I feel real liberation, when I can get to the point of a song being fully realized and alive in the world, for whatever that might mean to anybody.
Right. And I understand that you got some bad news, health news, last fall. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Last November, November 15th, I got a phone call that told me that I had stage 4 prostate cancer, which means that it jumped the rails from my prostate and into my bones. Not the phone call I was hoping for.
No, of course not. Yeah. So how are you doing now? What's your prognosis?
I'm doing remarkably well. I've responded really, really well to treatment. I am in remission. I feel better than I've probably felt in a few years, in fact. So, you know, I still wrestle day to day with the psychic specter of this, you know, just what it means to walk around under the umbrella of uncertainty. But in truth, Doug, we all live completely beneath an umbrella of uncertainty. You know,
That's true.
Really aware of it. You know, my future has always been unwritten. It's just newly unwritten, you know?
Yeah. You wrote the 13 songs that are on the new album, The Gospel According to Water, after you received the diagnosis, correct?
All but two of them. Two of them I had written on the west coast of Ireland in the fall, you know, probably within, you know, 4 or 5 weeks of me getting home and receiving this diagnosis. And what's curious to me is that those songs seem to be just as aware, in a way, as the songs that came after my diagnosis. The songs already knew something that I consciously did not know.
This little we can leave behind will truly mark this earth. But treachery and love are ours to keep for all their worth. The flower of our rise, it is a bloom, blood dark but clear. You hold it in your open hand to carry on from here.
What do you hear in the songs on the new album?
I hear myself being alive and fully engaged, and I feel, you know, light moving through me. You know, I hear the songs as being very alive. You know, I'm affirmed by their existence and the fact that I think that they have a strength and integrity of their own. You know, the process of writing and recording these songs sort of realigned me to myself, that I feel like, you know, for a moment, was threatened. And, you know, I retreated for a moment, but, you know, the songs kind of brought me out.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the songs. Can you tell me about the title track, The Gospel According to Water?
I have a very visceral memory of, you know, getting in bed with my notebook one night, and I just saw my hand write that title across the top of a page.
How else could go my gospel? Who else would I be saved? Without you as the water standing here behind this way.
It just sort of was there waiting for me, and I didn't know to what it pertained, you know. It just felt spring-loaded, and I knew if I engaged it, something, you know, was there to find. And I just sort of let it unwind, and it seemed to be telling a narrative, though not a linear one, about confronting darkness and living above it, you know, living not in opposition to reason, but outside of reason and far beyond reason. I think the song is about kind of embracing and riding the wave, you know, that's already there moving, you know, that we don't create it, we're joining it.
You said that some people find your songs confusing. Why do you think that's the case?
As much as I come out of a folk tradition, I come out of a poetic tradition. Our culture contemporarily is not taught to engage with poetry, you know. We're told that poetry is difficult. We're taught that it's not for everybody, that the hallmark of poetry is that it will make no sense to you. You know, so if I'm writing songs, I'm coming out of that tradition of using words to create atmosphere, to abstract things, not explain things. many listeners have this idea that you're already decoding something by putting it into words. You know, you're already breaking down experience and explaining it. But if you actually are using words to paint with and to create shadow and to remind everyone listening that, there's a greater mystery at play, people might find it difficult because we're not, as a culture, we're not taught anymore to engage with that kind of language. And yeah. I do come out of that tradition. I'm not trying to be difficult, but I'm delighted when a phrase appears that I don't really know what it means. It just means that it is. And I know that yeah. it's, even if I can't explain it, I can hear immediately when I write it that it's true, true to me. There is no sound left in these walls. The hallowed ground and long ago heard it all.
In the liner notes, you write that where a song comes from is not what a song is, and you actually write that again to make sure that the reader gets the point. Can you explain what you mean by that statement?
Well, sure. I mean, I got a diagnosis of cancer, and all of these songs kind of grew out of that experience, but none of these songs are about cancer. Uh-huh. I would never write a cancer song. That doesn't interest me. My reluctance in sharing my diagnosis, again, was not about fear about my privacy, to protect my privacy. It's really just about, I don't want anyone, if they know that, to then try to hear that song only that way. I think it's really limiting sometimes for people to know like where a song came from, because then they're tempted to think that that's the only experience they can have. That's my experience as a writer. And if a listener is only thinking about what my experience was writing it, then the song didn't happen. The song is not viable and it's not flexible. It's not standing up into the mystery of that tradition. It's getting nailed to the floor. That's not where music lives.
Yeah. I was very intrigued by the way you used the clarinet on this album, played by your son, Yvonne. It's used especially beautifully to my ears on Mule and Orson Welles. Clarinet sounds kind of fuzz tony. What part do you think the clarinet plays in the listener's experience of these two songs?
Well, I do think Levon just plays it beautifully. You know, in Mule in particular, it just sounds like a human voice to me. It sounds like a voice that carries on the song where there's no lyric. I want to hear humanity available. And I think Levon's reed playing is especially powerful at sounding human.
I was intrigued by your references to the idea of silence in two of the songs on the album. In Green of the Afternoon, there are the lines, "You come to me and silence every word, but what goes unspoken may not go unheard." And then these words struck me as a callback to the earlier song, Mule, in which the lyrics include, "Speaking with a silence deep as sound and holding us with silence deep as sound." Can you talk a bit about the theme of silence as it applies to these two songs?
I know that both of those are referencing my time in the west coast of Ireland last fall. My wife and I were stationed in a small seaside village called Ballyvaughan in County Clare in the area called the Burren. I was a writer in residence at a small art college there. And I became really aware, especially at night, that there was the silence I was hearing was not just a void of sound, that silence itself had a deep character, and it wasn't fragile. The random sound, you know, of a train passing or a cow in the night didn't destroy silence. It just punctuated it, let me know something about its depth. But I realized the silence I was hearing had a really, really deep and strong character, and it wasn't fragile. It had its own integrity, in the same way that peace is not just the absence of violence. Peace is a decision, and it's something on its own that needs to be nurtured and recognized. And silence is not just absence. Silence is a quality and a character that is really powerful.
Joe Henry, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for your time.
You come to me and you silence every word. You come to me and you silence every word. Thank you. What goes unspoken may not go unheard.
Joe Henry is a singer, songwriter, and producer. His album is called The Gospel According to Water. You can find out more about Joe and the album at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Dana Schwartz, Gary Goldman, and Joe Henry. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week.
All it takes is a phone and an open mind.
Online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Why aren't you calling?
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Skippy, don't let Friedrich bother you. He's this Euro trash guy.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
Where's my airplay? I have the radio tuned to that station you told me all weekend, and my song never came on.